Welcome to the Bibliopod, Maclean's Magazine's podcast of all things literary. In today's episode, we're going to delve into Harper Lee's long-lost novel, Go Set a Watchman, published this week amid huge fanfare. And we'll investigate our fascination with cookbooks with Amelia Tarangi, the publisher of Fiden Press, which produces some of the most beautiful and coveted cookbooks out there. I'm Anne Kingston, a writer with Maclean's.
I'm Brian Duthane, writer at Maclean's.
So, Brian, after months of hype and controversy, Harper Lee's novel Go Set a Watchman, a precursor to her To Kill a Mockingbird, the classic American favorite, is finally available. We should probably begin by providing a little background for anyone who somehow managed to miss all of the hoopla that surrounds it.
I suppose that's conceivable, if scarcely likely. Harper Lee is now 89, and her iconic novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, is 55 years old itself. The book won the Pulitzer Prize, and helped by a powerful film version, still sells a million copies a year. For more than half a century, she said nothing about it, nor did she release another novel. And then suddenly, last winter, the original novel, The Mockingbird, from which this one grew, had been found. Well, Go Set a Watchman is out, and the verdicts are in. What have we learned, Anne?
Let's talk a little bit about the drama surrounding the fact that Harper Lee, who was sort of a one-hit wonder, a miraculous one-hit wonder of an American author, really the question marks surrounding her involvement and willingness to have this book out there. The question became, was it something that she agreed to? And there was a lot of, I suppose, speculation caused by the fact that her sister, who had handled her literary matters, had died just before this book was somehow discovered.
Right. It's hard to believe that even if she didn't know where it was, now that she was 88, as she was when it was found, she didn't know for decades where it was. And so it comes a question of, you know, does she have the capacity to consent? Did she always want to make something of this book, to bring it out by itself, or to turn it into a real sequel to Mockingbird? We don't know, but it's one of the questions hanging over it.
Well, I think the other question that comes out of this, and it's a rich sort of field of discussion that we can't get into all of it right now, is the role of the editor. Because obviously this was the first, as you mentioned, this is the first book. This gave birth to Mockingbird through an editorial judgment that the story should focus not on the grown Scout, but Scout as a 6-year-old girl became the narrator, and focusing on the issues of race, which in the late 1950s and 1960, when the book was published, were paramount in American cultural life.
Yeah, far more than trying to deal with a coming-of-age story that is at least proto-feminist. The original novel is about Scout, coming to terms with the modern world, with her father. She's troubled, she's unhappy, and she doesn't have language yet to express it. She is part of what would be a burgeoning feminist movement in a few years, but at the moment she's not able to really articulate what's bothering her.
Well, but the original book, I mean, Go Set a Watchman, was in fact, I mean, as one reads it, I guess we could talk about the book itself at this point. The book itself is really about Scout. It's not about Atticus, and there has been a huge hue and cry about the fact that this beloved character is somehow far more complicated and, in fact, has a history of involvement with the Ku Klux Klan, as many people in the South did during that period, and also was a segregationist, which is a shocking turn of affairs.
You have to recall that Atticus is 72. He was born in 1883, I calculate. So, but yes, she originally wrote about Scout, which is to say, I would guess, about herself, and then it turned into something else.
Well, certainly by design, because an editor made that call that this story would be far more compelling if it was focused on a trial, if it was dealing with a six-year-old girl narrator, as opposed to a 26-year-old woman who didn't quite conform to.
Right, and it's not unreasonable because the childhood flashbacks are excellent.
Well, quite closely, they're almost word for word in some instances. So let's talk a bit, though, before we get to the actual text, about the fanfare that, and particularly having to do, you know, Amazon has stated it was their most pre-ordered book since the final book of the Harry Potter series in 2007. Right. And it strikes me that the Harry Potter kind of hoopla is sort of like the it is for books what Princess Diana's death was for grieving. It sort of set this bar in terms of, you know, everything else is measured by it. What did you make of all of this? I mean, HarperCollins, the publisher, printed 2 million copies.
That's
anticipating
right. And pushed pre-orders as much as possible. And you don't have to be entirely cynical to think that HarperCollins knew that half the people, at least, buying it would be deeply disappointed by some elements of it. And it would be a lot better to sell it to them before they knew what was in it.
Well, certainly the book that To Kill a Mockingbird is a far more palatable book. It's a feel-good book. It is far more emotional. This is a more cerebral book, and especially the ending, the end.
Well, I think it hits a moment in time that is not just a moment in racial relations time in the United States, but of other massive changes that are happening in the years after the war that are catching up. There's issues of class in here. There's social satire that's really very well done.
But we're not talking about that. We're just talking about Atticus. And this is where let's talk about the book, which I found very much engaging, and I enjoyed it, and powerful in parts, and more so than To Kill a Mockingbird. I loved the fact that it was a story of a 26-year-old woman who didn't want to get married, who didn't want to have children, who was prickly, who always took the difficult route in her life, who was a bit unconventional in the way she saw the world in terms of her own choices. I really liked that aspect of it. It's not a book. Harper Lee wasn't writing a book about Atticus Finch. She was writing a book about a young woman's relationship with her father, who just happened to be Atticus Finch.
Right, but she's also strangely blind to those around her. She doesn't, the writer points out several times, she just doesn't notice when people are in distress talking to her. She's blind to her own privileges. She's an interesting character, for sure.
As you say, though, it's a great canvas with which to discuss issues of class, which is something that isn't discussed commonly in American literature. Yeah. And everybody talks about race and To Kill a Mockingbird and its role in that kind of discussion about race. But I felt that this book drilled into issues about the core of bigotry and also how race feeds into all of this in a way that To Kill a Mockingbird certainly didn't.
Yeah, how the racism supports the class structure. Yes, exactly.
So what did you think of the book?
I really liked it, especially at the beginning. Reading through it, I could not understand why some editor went like, "Man, just give me the childhood stuff." Not at all. And then I could see where, all right, it is still a draft. It could do with some more work, especially near the end. It starts to become a little didactic for me. But overall, I thought, and I tend to look at things historically, I thought it was an excellent capture of a moment. And I'm trying to put myself back there and think, yeah, this is good. This is really what is happening underneath the surface and what's going on. It gave me a feel about The Graduate and Plastic People. That this was the 60s of Borning.
Right, and it captured the sense of ferment. I mean, I thought there were all sorts of nice aspects of this book. I heard this Southern kind of cadence in my head while I was reading it. I loved the taxonomy of small-town living and her criticism of the small-mindedness of it through, as you say, this lens of privilege that she wasn't even aware of.
Right.
But I feel that if you look back, though, and think about what an editor at a big publishing house in the late 50s would be thinking in terms of what America would be willing to digest, I don't think this book is it by a long shot.
No.
And certainly whoever made the calls in terms of, as you say, let's redirect this and make it about this great dramatic court case.
Yeah, which is only half a page here.
Well, you were telling me
with
about
a different verdict.
Exactly. And that's one of these, where you wanted a kind of continuity person there to seal that up. So do you feel that the conversation about what does it say about us that we're so focused on Atticus Finch in terms of the cultural discussion of this book? Is it because of his role is the symbolism that people want to believe that men like him exist and are somehow impervious to human failing?
That's right. And because he was, as the film is all important in this, and Gregory Peck is all important in this, and he inspired, people have named their children Atticus. People have become a lawyer because of Atticus. He's just a completely iconic character, and I think that's really going to throw this off. There's no separating him from this.
Well, isn't it a fact, you were telling me about a statue in front of the...
Yeah, the Alabama Bar Association has put up one statue to a lawyer in its entire existence, and that lawyer is a fictional character.
Which tells you all you need to know about the Alabama
law,
Bar.
Yeah.
So where would you like to see? I mean, is it possible to look at this book, obviously not, as straight text, as a... we used to talk about it in comparative literature. Is it possible for somebody to pick up this book and read it cold without having seen the movie or read To Kill a Mockingbird?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it stands as a book. It makes you think about what really Harper Lee was planning. There's rumors now, hints of a third book somewhere in there, pages thereof. Is there a trilogy when Scout is... another 20 years down the road? Did she always plan to do something with the unused parts of this, but was so astonished by her, the response to Go Kill a Mockingbird?
We don't know, though, whether she was dismayed or astonished, or whether her original intent was realized in the finished book, which was so phenomenally successful.
Right. Well, she'd make a great novel right now.
Well, this entire situation would be ripe for a novel. But I have to say, a book about Jean-Louise Finch 20 years hence is one I would certainly be interested in reading.
Yes, let's see what she made of the 70s. Yes.
Today we're going to talk cookbooks with Amelia Tarangi, the publisher of Fiden Press, the publishing house famed for producing books about art, architecture, and design. Fiden entered the cookbook market in 2005 with a bang when it published The Silver Spoon, a 1,500-page reformatting of an Italian cookery Bible. Since then, it has become a major force and industry leader in the thriving and hugely competitive food and cookbook market. Its long list of titles include Noma by René Redzepi, Il Bulli, 2005 to 2011, The LaRousse Book of Bread, and most recently, Corey Lee's Bennu. Welcome to the Bibliopod, Amelia. You were instrumental in bringing The Silver Spoon to an international audience. How did that come about?
Well, I am Italian, first of all. And this is a book I've grown up with. It was a book that was in my family. It was a book that my mom used, and it was also the book that my grandma used. So we grew up with this book, and I had no idea who the publisher was. I had no idea that it's never been translated into English. And then completely by chance, I was visiting the Italian publisher of this book for another project that was actually a design project. And while we were talking, I've asked them if they had any book available. And they just said, well, actually, funnily enough, we have only a cookbook. And it was something that just said without the intention of selling to us, because at the time we were not doing cookbooks. And I was very surprised. And then I thought, well, this is very interesting. And this is a book that's been so successful in Italy for over 50 years. Why shouldn't it work anywhere else? And so in a very kind of not really thinking what we were doing, we acquired the rights. And we started the translation and new photography and new packaging and everything. And I think that if we knew what we were going to do, probably we wouldn't have done it. But it was such a success that it completely paid off.
Now, I want to ask you, I was going to ask you why it hit such a nerve. But before I do, I have to ask you what you just said about if you had known. What are you speaking of specifically?
Well, It was our first cookbook. And if you start like this with a book that has over 2,000 recipes and you have never edited the recipes in your life, it's a big challenge. And we were really not, we didn't know how to do, what were the rules. So the good things is that we hired very good professionals to help us. And with our instinct, with the fact that I'm Italian and that I knew not all the recipes, but quite a few of them, I knew that the recipes were very good because I've used them and because I know they were very popular in Italy. And we just wanted to do a book that everyone could use. So we practically rewritten most of the recipes because, you know, the way in which Italian follow the recipes is very different. Well, from an American audience.
Yes, in a way they don't follow the recipe as religiously.
Well, first of all, they don't follow the recipes, but those recipes are very, very short because so many things are given for granted. A lot of the measurements are not precise, and there is one thing in the Italian way of writing recipes that I found quite amusing. For all the condiment, they put QB, that means quanto basta, and in English means as much as you need.
Yes.
And it's this way, it's completely different, but we were very careful to do something that was good for an American audience, and so we practically rewritten all the recipes so that they can really be used and people can really cook delicious meal.
Well, one of the striking aspects of that book, which I have in my own kitchen, is it just the design of it, the physical object of it. I'm curious about how you decided on that format, and also the fact that the spine lies flat in the kitchen, which is, if you cook, very important in a cookbook, and certainly not the case in a lot of cookbooks.
Well, this was really one of the first things that we thought about because the book ended up being 1,500 pages. And we know in the book industry, when a book started to go over a certain amount of pages, it becomes really difficult to open flat. And we tried a lot of different size and paper and thickness because for us it was very important to avoid that when you open the book, it just doesn't stay open. And the other thing that was for us very important was that we never go over leaf with the recipes. So the recipes, they all finished at the end of the page because also another thing that is very annoying, you are following the recipes and then you have to turn the pages to see what's happened. And so there were small details that for us were very important to make sure that it was friendly and it was easy to use and people want really to cook from.
Well, I'm wondering also, why do you think it was a runaway success? It seemed to just strike a chord. Is it simply because the authenticity of it? I'm curious to know what your perspective is and why the cookbook was so successful.
Yeah, I think that it's the real deal somehow. It's a little bit like the joy of cooking in America. So it's a kind of staple for the kitchen. And the main reason is the quality of the recipes, but also Italian food and Italian cuisine is incredibly popular. It's very easy to make, and it's quite healthy. So I think that the combination of all those things made this book a great success.
Now, we've seen the cookbook morph from something that you cook from to something that you can also simply look at or which serves as a point of inspiration. I'm thinking, for instance, of The French Laundry by Thomas Keller, which was published in 1999. But last year, Fiden published the Cookbook Book, which was a roundup of these, you know, more than 100 beautiful, influential cookbooks from 100 years, including one Salvador Dali produced, and also some offbeat one called Singers and Swingers in the Kitchen, which was an old British sort of rock and roll cookbook in a way. Are we wrong in thinking of the cookbook as a coffee table book as a modern invention?
It is definitely a modern invention, but while we were doing the research for this book, it was fascinating the amount of cookbook that has been published in the last 100 years. And some were useful, some were amusing, some were just coffee table books. So this book somehow, it's like a small survey of how huge is this world and how creative it is. So there are recipes that are for home cook, there are recipes for really, really high-end chef, and books that are from artists and really, you don't really know why people did the book and how it was put together, but they have this incredible quality that you really want to know more about it. And the interesting things about this book is that all the books are reproduced in their size, so you can really read the recipes. Even if it's only one page, you really have the real flavor of what the book is about.
I want to ask you about the design of cookbooks, because Faden's books are so, well, renowned for just as beautiful objects themselves. And specifically, let's talk about one of your most recent books, which is Bennu, Corey Lee's book. The restaurant of the same name in San Francisco is one you can't get into, so the cookbook is almost the next best thing to being there. Now, this is a book, the photography is exquisite. There's a beautiful white cloth cover with a raised sort of almost dumpling shape. And there's also a grace note. There's a menu from the restaurant printed on translucent paper as an insert. All of this is quite, you know, it's lovely, but none of it is inexpensive. How do you weigh those decisions about what you want to convey in a cookbook beyond, you know, obviously simply the text and the imagery?
Well, first of all, our tradition is doing art and architecture books. So we always, for this kind of book, spend a lot of time trying to deliver something that is really exquisite and also that reproduce the art or the architecture or the design in the best way. But also for us, what is also important is that a book is not only about the content, it's not only the image and the words, but also the visual, the graphic. It's very important to deliver a message. There is no difference. We don't have a way of doing books for the art book and another different and kind of low level for the cookbook. For us, it's exactly the same. And what we do, we don't have in-house designers. We have an art director. And with the art director, we try to understand what is our vision for the book, or what is even the chef vision of his book. And then we commission what we think is the best graphic designer in the world to deliver this vision. So, for example, for Bennu, the cover is inspired by this incredible and delicate dumplings that the chef does, and that's one of his signature dish. But also the fact that the entire restaurant has this beautiful material. When you enter the restaurant, is this beautiful wood, and there is this incredible light, and everything is so perfect and minimal. And this is part of the experience at the restaurant. The way the chef cook and the meal that they deliver, they are such a high standard that nothing that is not perfection could be associated with them. So the book has to have the same level of perfection.
How do you decide whether you want to publish a book with a particular chef?
This is not only with chef book or cookbook, but for example also in architecture or design, I always say that there are a lot of objects that I would like to have in my apartment, but that doesn't mean that I would like to do a book about. And the same is with the chef. There are a lot of restaurants that are incredible. They are really, really good restaurants, and I would love to have a meal there, but this is not enough for me to think about a book. It's really, a book is about a message, is about a vision, is about contribution to the gastronomy. So it's not only a very good meal, it's about what is the position of this chef, of this restaurant, in the development of contemporary gastronomy?
Well, that's interesting because the menu cookbook is fascinating, but it's not a beautiful book to hold and to read and to think about. But it's not necessarily one that people who have it will cook from. For instance, you know, there are fantastic recipes. There's one that's eel fouille de brique, crème fraîche. It's not something that most people will think about, but perhaps just proximity with the idea of it is something that could inform the way they cook.
Absolutely. I think that it's like if you buy a monograph on the sculptor Richard Serra, you don't do it because you want to start to sculpt.
Right.
It's just because you want to know, you want to be inspired, you want to be part of this world. But what is interesting for me is that you can be inspired, you see a combination of flavor that you never thought, you see a beautiful plating, and all of this is really part of a much bigger image that you have about the gastronomy. And you feel that you are part of it. Is part of a knowledge.
How has publishing cookbooks changed the way you personally think about and eat food?
For me personally?
Yes.
Before I started to publish cookbooks, I have very, very few cookbooks in my apartment, one of which was The Silver Spoon in Italian. And since I started to publish it, I became more and more interested in this idea of reading about gastronomy and reading recipes that I think is quite fascinating. Through the recipes, through the cookbook, you know more about something that we actually do every day, that is eating.
What can you tell me about anything you're working on now?
So yeah, cookery. We will have a couple of books coming out in fall that I'm really excited about. One is another chef book by a Mexican chef that's called Enrique Olvera. His main restaurant is in Mexico City and it's called Pujol. And then he has a very successful restaurant in New York that's called Cosme. And the book is about his relationship, the relationship between high-end cuisine and Mexican home-cook cuisine. And the other one is a book about Nordic cooking, and it's done by Magnus Nielsen, who is a chef. We published a book about his restaurant, Faviken, who is in the middle of nowhere in the north of Sweden. And the interesting thing is that he traveled for 2 years in all the Nordic country to collect home cook recipes, and then he tested them and he delivered them in this book. And there are over 700 recipes.
Sounds wonderful and very delicious. We'll look forward to seeing that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Amelia Tarangi, publisher of Fiden Press. You've been listening to the Bibliopod for the weekend of July 17th. Please join us next time. Find new episodes at macleans.ca and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Beyond Pod. The Bibliopod is produced by Sarmishta Subramanian. Theme music is by Stephen Scratt and Asher Lenz. Additional music by Simon Gadke from his album Under the Red, White, and Blue. Thanks also to Anne Lavery and Scott Metcalf.